Let's get going with another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening back to the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, chapter number 6. We're going to start in verse 4 in just one moment. Reminder to those of you who are parents that have younger children, this is PG-13 material. So you need to get them busy elsewhere or you'll be having some additional education opportunities. This is probably not written by Solomon. Some people have suggested it is. I disagree with that. It is not written about Solomon, other than in a tangential way. I believe that this is an opera celebrating love and passion between two characters who are presented as working for King Solomon. The young man seems to be working with Solomon's horses, livestock. The young lady seems to be working in the palace itself, even having interaction with King Solomon and with the wives and concubines. But she also apparently in that work sometimes is taking care of the flock of goats that are there for the kitchen in the palace complex. And so this is how the two carry on their love affair. Now, keep in mind, I'm not suggesting that they're involved in sexual activity with this love affair. I'm just saying that they are allowing their passions to grow over time in this opera. Besides the two main singers, we also have a chorus from time to time. Sometimes I think it's probably females, sometimes I think it's males, sometimes it might be both singing here. You know how an opera works. And so we are at the point where he is singing, and great thank yous to the translators of the English Standard Version who made sure that we could see the headings of where the shift in the vocabulary, or excuse me, the grammar shows that it's the guy singing or the girl singing or a chorus singing. And at this point, he wants to tell her how beautiful she is, how desirable she is. And he uses language that he's used before, but he's also using the idea of beautiful cities that he's been to or knows about in describing how beautiful she is. So let's get on with the singing, how about? Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 4. The young man sings, "You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love." Tirzah was a beautiful city north of Shechem, a little ways. "Lovely as Jerusalem." And we know that Jerusalem is very beautiful because we're coming into that time period of its peak reconstruction by King Solomon. "Awesome as an army with banners." Think about a military parade, how beautiful it is. "Oh, turn your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me." So look away. I can't handle it when you look at me like that. "Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead." And so these goats are black, and so her tresses, her locks of hair are coming down off of her head, down onto her shoulders, looking like little lines of goats coming down off of the high country in Gilead. Verse 6, "Your teeth are like a flock of ewes. They've come up from the washing." In the earlier passage, they've been freshly shorn. They've had their winter wool taken off of them. So they're very, very white is the point. "All of them bear twins." That is, there's an upper tooth and a lower tooth. Twins. "Not one among them has lost its young." So you have beautiful white teeth. You're not missing a single one. It probably worked better in Hebrew, didn't it? "Your cheeks are like halves of pomegranate behind your veil." So if you take a pomegranate, slice it in half, it's very red on the inside. So she's probably got rouge cheeks very red cheeks that are just above her virgin's veil, because the custom was virgins, unmarried women, would wear veils across their mouth area, across their smile area. Then, this is where we stopped last time, and I said we were going to come back to it because I think it helps us understand the probable window of writing and performance of this opera. Verse 8, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. Now, we know that by the time that he comes to his death, Solomon has 700 full-fledged queens, princesses. These are very high-profile ladies that he's been married to as part of treaty arrangements between himself and other countries, as part of the sealing of deals. And these ladies, because they're full wives, they have a lot more rights and privileges. Well, there's only 60 mentioned here, so it must come fairly early on in the king's reign. My guess, and this is all it is that after King Solomon finished the building of the temple and then finished the building of his complex for governance, and that happened 20 years after he started the building of the temple, that would be his finishing time would be about the 24th year of his reign, being placed on the throne by King David. That sometime after he finished his complex, that's when the Queen of Sheba shows up, because he's being talked about everywhere in the world. And so I think he becomes a very desirable ally at that point, halfway through his kingdom. And that's when I am sure he starts having marriage contracts all over the place. Much to the teaching of God against that sort of thing, but I do think it helps understand where we're at here. We're probably still at the time when the temple is either being built or has recently been built, and the palace complex is under construction. 80 concubines, we know that the final number was 300. So even though that's 80 is about a quarter of that number, it's still considerably lower. And then the virgins mentioned here are probably the ladies in waiting all around this complex where the queens and the concubines live. They have to have attendants. And more often than not, those would be virgin attendants, young women, teenagers maybe, that have responsibilities to look after the kings, the queens and the concubines. So here's the point now. Verse 8, there are 60 queens, 80 concubines, virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. So basically, they are nothing compared to you. You are so much better, prettier, smarter than any of these ladies that are living in the palace complex. The young women saw her, meaning his beloved, his girlfriend, and called her blessed. The queens and concubines also, and they praised her. Now, I already mentioned on several occasions, I believe that this young lady in the opera works in the palace. She works with the royals. She's been in the presence of King Solomon on regular occasions. That's because she also works with the queens and the concubines on a regular basis. And so the young man is singing about the fact that you are so well known and approved of in the palace that even the royals talk about how wonderful you are. Verse 10, who is this who looks down like the dawn? See, she's She's so bright and something that you want. She's like the dawn in the morning, or beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun. She's awesome as an army with banners. So who can hold a candle to your beautiful light? And so now it's her turn to sing back, right? I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vines had buttered, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. So it's spring, perhaps, again, because we don't know how much time passes between the acts here. Is she getting older and they're still not married? I don't know. But we know from other occasions that he invited her to come out during the spring and enjoy the freshness of the blossoms of that time of year, and how there was also some worries about the foxes eating the little flowers off of the grapevines and stuff. So perhaps this is a later spring. And so she's talking about going back out, probably to meet him. Verse 12, before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsman, a prince. Now, that's the English Standard Version's translation. And they have probably translated out what was intended to be a proper noun. The Septuagint, the 3rd century BC translation from Hebrew into Greek, treats this as a proper noun, where it's the chariots of Ami, which means my people or my kinsmen, Nadib, which is the word for prince. And so more than likely, we're talking about the chariots of Ami Nadib, which may be the name of a city, because we know he has chariot cities, that is Solomon. Or it may be the name of a chariot complex, the chariots of the prince. And we already have established that this young man in the opera works with the horses, with the chariots of King Solomon. And so she goes out to look at the spring stuff, but she ends up going over to where he works instead. Verse 13, we have the chorus sing. Return, return, O Shulamite. Return, return, that we may look upon you. And so this may be the young men singing, that they want her to come back so that they can look at her again. And that then brings this response from the young man. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? Or possibly, and I believe this is how the Septuagint deals with it, a proper noun, Mahanaim, the two armies, which we know was one of the fortified royal cities on the east side of the Jordan in Gilead. And there's a lot of vocabulary that appears throughout here that the people working for Solomon seem to also travel with Solomon. So they're well aware of all the different places in the kingdom, within the empire of King Solomon. So he says, why do you want to look upon the Shulamite, which I've told you, I think it's probably Shunammite, which was the name of a person from the town Shunem, which was in the Esdraelon Valley, the Jezreel Valley, just a little south and east from the city of Nazareth. That's probably where she came from, and so that's how she's referred to. So why do you want to look at her like you'd look upon a dance of the dancers at Mahanaim? Apparently a special dance going on there. And then he sings to her directly. Chapter 7, verse 1. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter. So I love looking at your feet. They're beautiful. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. This is what I told you. This is PG-13 material. He is definitely looking at her, taking her in to his mind and imagining being with her in a very intimate fashion. I don't think that's happening yet. It's possible it might have, but there's some things coming up in a little bit that suggest to me that they are still not yet married and therefore would not be intimate with one another. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Now, again, some people think that they are already married and they're very intimate, and he is describing her naked body. I don't think that's necessary because, okay, guys, let's acknowledge the fact that guys' imaginations can go pretty wild when they're looking at the one they love, right? And so I think that's what's going on here, is he's imagining her in the way that he'd like to be with her. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. So you look great. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Before he described it as like the Tower of David with all the shields on it, probably referencing the necklace that she wore. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabin. And so another place in the empire. And so he describes her eyes like beautiful little pools. Maybe they were blue. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. Most modern-day ladies would not like their nose being described like a tower. But this is not a problem in this culture, because it was a point of beauty to have that very strong nose feature. And so she's got a powerful nose. And your head crowns you like Carmel. Carmel was the ridgeline that separated the area south from the area north, there at the breakpoint of the Jezreel Valley. It terminates on the northwest end as that little bump that goes out into the Med. And so that's Mount Carmel, and it was always thought of as a very beautiful place. And so he says, you've got a beautiful head. It is beautiful like Mount Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. Now, her hair is not purple, unless, of course, there was a cultural time where they did some tinges like we have in our modern day of adding a little bit of dye to your hair. We know before that it's been described as being black. So I think it may be more the idea of it's beautiful like purple silk when it kind of drapes down perfectly. That's, I think, what he's got in mind. A king is held captive in the tresses. And that may be a nod again to King Solomon, thinking that this is a lovely young servant girl of his, very beautiful. Verse 6, oh, how beautiful and pleasant you are. Oh, loved one, with all your delights. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. So your overall body is like a lovely palm tree when it has all of its fruit clusters. And your breasts are like those fruit clusters. And then he says something that is very forward. I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. So I would love to be very intimate with you, is what he is saying here. And again, PG-13 material, This is all for adults in this opera, but it is a celebration of that passionate love that men and women, husbands and wives, have toward one another. She sings back, "It goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth." He just mentioned wine. She's mentioned wine before in association with kissing, and how she loves that. And so, yeah, she's all on board with this. "Yes, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me." So they have this back and forth of wanting to be with one another in an intimate fashion. "Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages," or some translations, something about the henna plants again, which have been mentioned before. Remember that a lot of their private time is spent when they're on their siesta, midday siesta, taking care of Solomon's animals. That their couch is the green grass, the rafters on their banqueting house is that's all the branches of the trees above them, things like that. They like to spend time in nature together. And so that seems to be what they're singing about right now. "Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom." So once again, it's spring, and we all love the smells of spring. "There I will give you my love." The idea probably of the kissing and things that are going on here. Promises of the future. Verse 13, "The mandrakes give forth fragrance." Mandrake roots have long been associated as an aphrodisiac. That's true. But the flower above ground, the plant with the flower above ground, is very beautiful, and it smells wonderful. And so that is, again, in bloom because of the spring. And so the mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. The fig trees are mentioned in other parts of this opera as the early figs are starting to ripen. But the reality is, for fig trees, often there's old figs from last year, from the previous season, that have wintered over. And so you've got old figs and new figs on the same fig tree at the same time. And that might be what she's referencing in her song here. Now, chapter 8, as she continues singing, this is where she says something that I believe indicates they're not yet married. And this is what she sings. "Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you, and none would despise me." So, people, unmarried young people growing up together, male and female, they can show public displays of affection to one another because they're related by blood. It's no big deal for a brother and a sister to give a hug to one another out in open, and to even give that two-sided cheek kiss, or maybe even, you know, a non-greeting kiss on the cheek to just let you know, "I love you, I care about you," right? So that's no big deal. That's not appropriate for people not married to each other, men and women not married to each other, to do that sort of public display of affection. And so what she's expressing here is, I wished I could show you how I feel like about you out in the open, but I can't because you're not my brother. Now, of course, she wouldn't want him to be her brother because she wants to have him as her husband instead. Now, I do wonder just how much public display of affection was permitted among betrothed people, probably not much, is my guess, or even married people. Would that be allowed? I work in different contexts where you've got children around, like camps and schools, and public display of affection is usually off the table between husbands and wives in that context because, well, the reason for it is because you want to be much more professional in front of the kids to make sure that you are attending to their needs rather than distracting them with your own affection with somebody else. And so it's possible they had a cultural thing about that too, that maybe, just maybe, they are already married, but PDA is not acceptable in the public. But I think there's an off chance of that. I think it's much more likely they're not married yet. Because she then goes on to say, I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I'd give you spiced wine to drink and the juice of my pomegranate. My left hand, or excuse me, his left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. So now we get back to this idea. I wished I could have some private time with you in my family home, you know, where I live with my mom. Apparently mom had a place there in Jerusalem where this lady works. She describes him holding her and caressing her. Now, some commentators go with a very intimate caressing here. I'm not so sure that's the case. But we finish with something we've seen three or four times already. Verse 4, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. And each time we've come to that, I've said, I think this is probably the point of the opera, is don't rush love. Let it take its time. Let it develop over time so that you can enjoy it to its fullest at just the right moment.